the state of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. Welcome you all to the Supreme Court hearing room. We have two petitions to be presented for public hearing, and we will then discuss these two rules petitions as well as rules petition 0907 relating to the expunction of circuit court records, and John Velker and Jean Fusquet will make a presentation to us. So we go first to 0501 in the matter of the petition for amendment to Supreme Court Rule 22.001 sub 3 relating to cost assessments in the lawyer regulation system. The presenter will be James Bowell and Dean Diedrich, and we have appearances by William Weidel and Dan Schneidman. Are there any other appearances for that petition? Okay. Mr. Bowell, you take the podium, and I'm going to make a preliminary statement of the issue of how to assess costs in the Office of Lawyer Regulation has come up before. That's why it has a number 0501, which indicates it was first raised in 2005. And at that time, Mr. Saleen, Director of the Office of Lawyer Regulation, filed a petition relating to costs, and the State Bar of Wisconsin opposed that and offered an alternative approach, which it developed along with Mr. Saleen. There was a public hearing in 2005, and the court at that time adopted a revision to 22.24 sub 2 relating to costs and said that the order would expire December 31, 2008, and so prior to December 31, 2008, we held a hearing, but we didn't have enough information to make any changes, so we put it off until 2010 with an expiration of December 31, which is why we're gathered here today. Costs have raised significant concerns for this court over a period of years, and the petition that was adopted, or the rule that was adopted by a 4-3 vote at the time of adoption. So we are here today to look at this once again. And that's my statement to bring everybody up on the same page. Hopefully I did it correctly so we're on the correct page. Mr. Bowell.
May it please the Court. Madam Chief Justice, member of the Court. My name is Jim Bowell, and I'm the President of the State Bar of Wisconsin. At the last Board of Governors meeting, which took place on September 24th, the Board voted unanimously to approve proposed language modifications to SCR 2216, proceedings before a referee, and SCR 2244, assessment of cost proposals, advanced by the Professional Ethics Committee. I'm honored here today to introduce Attorney Dean Diedrich, the Chair of the State Bar's Professional Ethics Committee, to outline the Bar's position. For two decades, Attorney Diedrich has served as a member of the State Bar's Professional Ethics Committee. He's a past member of the Board of Governors and has had numerous leadership positions within the State Bar. Mr. Diedrich also served on the court-appointed committee that proposes comprehensive changes to the rules of professional conduct for Wisconsin attorneys and is a member of both the ABA Center for Professional Responsibility and the Association of Professional Responsibility Lawyers. On behalf of the State Bar of Wisconsin's 24,000 members, I'd like to invite Mr. Diedrich to the podium to advance the State Bar's position regarding this petition.
Thank you. Attorney Diedrich.
May it please the Court, Madam Chief Justice and members of the Court. I believe you have the submittal from the President of the State Bar, and let me make some introductory comments and then answer any questions you may have. The matter that you are looking at today involves, of course, the issue of assessment of costs in lawyer discipline proceedings. I just want to reconfirm something I think you you may know but may not appreciate the degree of importance that cost assessments have in the deliberations and the considerations that lawyers enter into when deciding what steps or what position they should take in lawyer discipline cases. Many would think that the importance of innocence and the importance of what the issues are in the merits of the lawyer discipline proceeding would be utmost, and they certainly are utmost. But I will also tell you that the apportionment of costs and the potential of a cost assessment is something that is very serious to those lawyers who are subject to disciplinary proceedings. You have developed and implemented a system in which certain weighing process take place by the court in deciding how to apportion costs in a lawyer discipline case. I stand before you today to say that discussion and the weighing process is something that is looked at very seriously by the lawyer involved in the proceeding, and I think the court has correctly decided that there should be a weighing process, there should be an assessment process to determine whether all or a portion of the costs of the proceeding should be assessed against the lawyer. And I would recommend and concur that weighing process should continue. The State Bar asks that this court consider one additional step in the process. Currently, when a matter is scheduled for hearing before a referee issues a recommendation that goes before the court. It is our recommendation and our request of this court that the rules be amended to allow the referee to make a recommendation to the court on the assessment of costs. We are asking this in order for the court to have the benefit of the eyes and the ears of the referee who is trying the proceeding, who is seeing the exact arguments being presented in the hearing, who is seeing the weight that is given by the prosecutor and the defense to the various counts of the proceeding, and to make a recommendation to the court on how that apportionment of costs should be made. Our recommendation and our request of the court is that the recommendation of the referee be part of the proceedings going before the court. There is still the process of addressing the apportionment of costs in the court proceedings before this court as you, the justices, may see fit. But we would ask you to consider adding that step in the process.
Mr. Diedrich, the bar has done more than just add a step. First of all, they changed the criteria. They took out the concept of extraordinary circumstances. And that is a very important concept.
We would not disagree with the continuation of that criteria as part of your current criteria.
All right. So you wouldn't object to having what we have now. What you would do is say, instead of it initially coming to court, you would do it to the referee. You would have it go to the referee after the referee makes the recommendation, because what has happened before and still is happening is the referee makes a recommendation, of course, and has nothing before him or her, has no bills before them, just makes it out of what appears to be their own judgment without knowing criteria. So that's the one thing I have. So this is not intended necessarily to change our criteria. It's intended to just have a referee initially decide it and then the court review it.
That is okay. Correct, Chief Justice. And I think the timing we have in there would allow for some of the submittals by the Office of Lawyer Regulation.
Right, afterwards. I think what you do is we had 20 days. You have the 20 and 10, so that's neither here nor there. Two, you put the burden of proof on the director, and you put it on clear and convincing evidence as to the costs. One, I don't know why you need a middle burden rather than the regular burden on costs. And two, why shouldn't the burden be on the respondent saying, don't assess me full costs because? And three, why would you put the burden of proof on the OLR to do the respondent's ability to pay? I mean, they'd have to subpoena his financial records or her financial records. I mean, the burden just seems to be wrong here.
With regard to the burden, Chief Justice, the most important point I would make to this court is that the proceedings are being brought by the Office of Lawyer Regulation. And within the context, they are making the charging decisions. What counts are going to be pursued? So for purposes of determining the costs, while we ask the referee to assess the success or failure in the determination of those charges, we think that the burden should be on the Office of Lawyer Regulation, who has brought the charges in the first place, to bring forward justification for the costs, bring forward justification for an apportionment that they are recommending based upon the presentation that they've made to the referee. We understand and acknowledge that it would be the responsibility of the respondent to provide information to the court regarding the ability to pay. And we understand that would be something that the respondent would provide in the course of the response to the statement made by the Office of Lawyer Regulation.
Now, I can understand a burden of proof that I spent X number of hours over Y number of days should be on the person who submits the bill. But it would seem to me that if you use the standard that the court used in its rule about extraordinary circumstances and then the criteria, I mean, what kind of burden of proof do you show there by clear and convincing evidence?
Well, if I may, Chief Justice, again, because they're the originator, I think the Office of Lawyer Regulation should have some burden. If there is a claim by the Office of Lawyer Regulation that there are extraordinary circumstances that have caused it to pursue a case as it has pursued it, or has caused it to do unusual amounts of investigation, they should be obligated to prove that and provide support for that.
Sure.
Rather than it being called upon as the respondent to argue against that.
Well, what's the matter with the present rule that the OLR's recommendation should explain why the particular amount of costs is being sought? Objection shall be filed by motion. A respondent who objects must explain with specificity the reasons for the objection and state he or she what he and she considers a reasonable amount of costs. Do you have any objection to that?
For the most part, Chief Justice, I would not object to that wording. I would again respond to the court, however, that what you are asking and what the current rule asks is for the Office of Lawyer Regulation not to justify the bringing of a certain level of charges, but rather simply to make their statement of what their costs are. And then all the burden flows to the respondent to pick at that. And again, as the charging agency, there should be some responsibility for that charging agency to justify the expenditure of costs.
Well, then you do change the criteria, because the present one is the respondent, if found to have violated the code, pays all costs except under extraordinary circumstances not pay costs or not pay all of them.
Extraordinary circumstances or the other criteria as well.
Well, first you have to find that there's something unusual about this case. The fact that you prove 2 out of 3 counts is not unusual. But there's something unusual about this case in terms of not only numbers charged, but the contesting of it and the proof of it and the severity of the nature of the offense, et cetera. So,
I would simply comment, Chief Justice, in to be consistent with the notion that there should be a look at the appropriateness of the rule of assessing all costs, that the extraordinary circumstances, there should be some explanation of that by the charging party.
Well, right now, the general rule is you do not allocate costs. The respondent pays them all. Under certain circumstances, you can reduce the cost the respondent pays. That's the rule. You want to change the rule so that there's no general rule that the respondent pays them all?
What we're asking, Your Honor, is not to change the rule, but to establish the process to make it more appropriate for parties to explain their position.
All right. And you want it through the referee first and then the court.
That's correct.
Got it. Thank you. And when you say not change the rule, I need to know, Attorney Dietrich, how this works, because it sounds to me like it is changing the rule more than just the referee. And I'll tell you, the linchpin of it for me is this extraordinary circumstances and how that plays out. Right now, of course, there is a presumption that all fees assessed would be assessed absent extraordinary circumstances. And then there are criteria to examine. I'm not sure of the interplay. It makes me think of there is a change, because it isn't clear to me how this burden of proof that you're now wanting to put on OLR and extraordinary circumstances that you want to retain intersects. OLR likely will come and say, give us all your eights, we want your money. And so they're not going to want to show extraordinary circumstances to deviate from that. And yet OLR under your proposal has the burden. So how does extraordinary circumstances come into play? And it seems to me that there's a change in what you're saying. Help me with that, if you will.
Yes, I will, Justice. Thank you. I would first comment to you, Justice Bradley, and to the Court, that very much the linchpin or the most important focus of our proposal is to involve the referee in the proceeding, because we believe that that individual has the ability to make assessments about extraordinary circumstances and about the conduct of the proceeding. The other item that I would reference with regard to the issue of extraordinary circumstances is that there should be some expectation on the part of the charging party to explain in effect to justify the extension of costs. And here's why. Because in a proceeding where the Office of Lawyer Regulation brings forward their statement of costs, the respondent is then required to explain why there are extraordinary circumstances, to explain what the difficulties have been, and I can recall cases before this Court where there has been discussion regarding the difficulties in a processing of a case, and then the Office of Lawyer Regulation comes back again, or at least arguably comes back again, if there is some justification presented at the start of the proceedings, the start of the submittal, I should say, for the cost. That then affords that case, that argument, to be squarely hit by the parties, rather through this kind of circular backdoor way of raising the issue. Seems to me you're bringing it up very late in the process.
Who has the burden then of bringing forward and the burden of proof on extraordinary circumstances?
The what I would submit on behalf of the State Bar, that there should be some presentation and statement on behalf of the Office of Lawyer Regulation, either as to the existence of extraordinary circumstances or the existence of a quote, regular proceeding. We all know that these are very seldom regular proceedings. That at least squares the issue for purposes of the respondent to come forward. It would seem to me that the respondent would have the burden of going beyond the declaration of extraordinary circumstances to show this court why there should be an apportionment, why there should be a reduction. So to that part of it, Chief, or Justice Bradley, I would say that to show the applicability of the factors, that would be the responsibility of the respondent.
A couple of things bother me with this. Number one, when we heard this a few years ago, there was a fiscal note attached to it, to the extent, as I recall, the Office of Lawyer Regulation suggested that we adopt the American rule, where each litigant would pay his or own, her own fee. And they brought a petition. We had asked them to study it. They brought a petition asking for that, and you, the state bar, I should say, opposed that petition. When they brought that petition to us after they studied the issue, because lots had been going on in the court, they said to adopt the American rule where each litigant would pay his or her own fees. They anticipated then that there would be an increase of dues for lawyers.
$3.
Of $3.
Or assessment.
Assessment, I'm sorry, thank you. Assessment of dues of $3. I think most of the court, but I speak only for myself, I really, in these economic times, am loath to take any step to increase assessments on anyone. It seems to me that your proposal will, in changing the burden of proof, rather than what we have now, there's a presumption that they would be assessed, and then you work to rebut that presumption. When I say presumption, I mean presumption that all would be assessed. So I'm confident there's a fiscal impact to what you're asking for that would increase the assessment of attorneys' dues. That causes me to hesitate. I'm going to also explain my second hesitation and then give you an opportunity to talk about both. My second hesitation is, when the State Bar came with that proposal, let's adopt the American rule. And, excuse me, when the OLR came with the petition, let's adopt the American rule, and the State Bar opposed it. The State Bar at that time recommended justices let the referee make the recommendations to the court regarding assessment of costs based on several criteria. Sounds a lot like what we're hearing today. And the court said, nope, we're going to put the brakes on because there's a study going on. The bench bar was doing a study of lawyers and judges on this very issue, a survey. And the majority of the judges voted, said, no, let's keep it the way it is, assessment of full costs, you know, that can be rebutted. And the options were given to the lawyers in this poll. And of those lawyers that responded, the largest number said, no, let's keep the status quo, which was to assess all costs against an attorney who's found to have a violation. So you've got the judges against your position. You have of the attorneys that responded to the poll, the most favored response was against your position. What has happened, and I understand now, I may be wrong, but I understand the OLR is against your position. I understand that from a reading a court memo. So what has happened between when we last addressed this, now this is going to be a hardball question, and here today, other than a change on the court? What leads you to say, oh, things have changed when the judges were against it, when the attorneys were against it, when OLR is against it? What causes you to want another kick at the cat asking for the same thing that you lost on a couple of years ago?
My first response to you, Justice Bradley, is to indicate that what has changed, or I should say not changed, but what has happened, is this court asking for and discussion and assessment of the rule to date and the progress to date. And truly, the State Bar, when it presented on this initially, as it stands here today, believes that the referee should be a part of that assessment process. Justice Bradley, you've also very appropriately worn on your shoulder the scales of justice. And the scales of justice in this case weigh and spin both sides very, very often. And it is very difficult to determine what is the most appropriate position. Certainly, lawyers, through an assessment process, should not be required to pay all costs when a lawyer has actually committed misconduct and is subject appropriately to discipline. So the scales weigh on that side, to not have that type of rule. On the other hand, the scales of justice would say to us that it isn't appropriate for a lawyer to be assessed the costs on 8 counts when 3 are proven. I don't have an answer to the weighing of that scales of justice. That's the beauty, I guess, of the scales of justice. I believe that the criteria that you provided allows this court to make an appropriate decision under the circumstances of each case. I believe that the court should seek the recommendation from the referee as assistance to this court in making that assessment.
And so what has changed? Those are the same arguments, Attorney Dietrich. I say with a smile on my face and fondness in my heart, but those are the same arguments that you made when the petition was brought before the court in January of 2005, when we had the public hearing in November of 2005, when the order was issued, and your position did not prevail. So my question is, what has changed that leads you, if anything, to lead you to think that listening to the same arguments, the court should change, other than the composition of the court?
I think what has changed is that for the past 2 years, this court has had to wrestle with a number of lawyer discipline cases. And part of that wrestling process has been assessment of costs. When cases come before you that are stipulated to, things move quicker. When things come before you with a contested case, you have to make difficult decisions regarding the assessment of costs. Well, and I believe that the inclusion of the referee in that proceeding is an improvement on your current process. So we believe that that should take place.
Mr. Dietrich, I had asked the OLR to provide the court with information about the fees. I think did you get a copy?
I did not get a copy of that.
Marshall, would you give Mr. Dietrich this? Thank you. It really shows that only in 2 reported cases the court disagreed with the OLR on finding and imposing less than full costs. In 1, Molinaro, the court unanimously agreed to cut the costs. And in Frisch, which is relatively recent, the court divided on whether to reduce the costs or not. So I asked the OLR to do this to see whether this was causing problems in the court and in the OLR. So sometimes there were partial costs recommended and we adopted it. Sometimes no costs were recommended and we adopted that. And in 78 out of 80 costs, cases, the OLR recommended full costs, and we did it in, they had recommended in 80, and we did it in 78 out of the 80, which is the Molinaro and Frisch. So this rule has worked well. And I don't think I object to the referee having a working in the area of costs. What I'm raising with you and what Justice Bradley raised with you is you're changing the criteria. You're changing the whole concept. The concept of the present rule is full costs except. And you are coming in and saying there is no presumption of full costs. It's wide open. And that I find difficult because that does open every single case to a review of costs. And according to this summary that you see here, there's a lot of money involved here. There was $204,000 in 09-10, $100,000 in 08-09, $166,000 in 07-08, $132,000 in 06-07. If we do what the bar is suggesting and change the, I don't really like to use the word presumption because it has legal connotations that don't fit, but the assumption here, this will be a, will result in a, potentially result in a bar assessment increase, if not the full $3, at least close to that. In addition to that, I think most of the issue of costs arise as to the lawyer fees of the OLR. The referee fees occasionally, but not very frequently because they're much lower in amount. And the other costs like transcribing, a court reporter, copying charge, transportation, if any, are really much smaller and people don't fight about. So one of the arguments was, which was the OLR position, is assess the respondent, the lawyer, with all costs except attorney fees so that we reduce the fights. But that in effect, is increasing the assessment.
That's correct, Your Honor. It would, Chief, it would, I assume, result in an increase in the assessment of the costs. I would further state, Chief Justice, that the Office of or the Wisconsin Supreme Court, excuse me, the State Bar of Wisconsin is not here raising an objection to the level of the hourly rate charged by the Office of Lawyer Regulation. That is not part of our concern here. Our concern here primarily is the involvement of the referee. I understand the argument you have presented with regard to the waiting process in the extraordinary circumstances, having been a participant in one of the cases that required that discussion at length, it was unfortunately a very difficult part of the case. I think it could stand some improvement, but very clearly, Justices, our issue for your consideration is the involvement of the referee.
Rather than the issues that Justice Bradley and I have been talking about.
You know, Mr. Dietrich, just so I'm clear on this, especially in light of one question that posed the potential that your presence and your position here are related somehow to a change on the court, my understanding from a review of this matter indicates that there was a sunset provision that went into effect in 2008. And so it was anticipated from the beginning of this rule that the matter would be reviewed in 2008. Indeed, it was reviewed in 2008. Am I correct so far?
You are correct, yes, sir.
And in 2008, at the open conference, the members of this court sat in open conference and decided that they did not have enough information to make an informed decision regarding the changes, which were anticipated to be reviewed anyway when the rule was passed. Is that all correct, Mr. Dietrich?
That is my understanding of the recitation.
So really, what we're doing here today is we are reviewing this matter now with additional information to determine what is most in keeping with this court's charge of fairness to all concerned. And so, therefore, What we are doing was anticipated from the beginning of this rule, and really, to phrase the argument in terms of a change in the established rule, is to presume something that doesn't exist, namely that a sunset provision would not include the idea of appropriate amendments being made with the information that shows how the adoption of the rule and the implementation of the rule has actually affected people and various agencies throughout this system.
First, I must state, Justice Gableman, that I was not here in 2008, so I can't speak as to what the consideration was at that time as to enough information. I will indicate, though, very clearly that we come here before you today knowing that this case has been calendared.
Mr. Dietrich, if I advised you that that was the upshot.
That could be, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. We come here today knowing this matter has been calendared for a look at the current rule. The State Bar of Wisconsin believes the involvement of the referee in the process is an important thing that should be added to your current process. That's why we appear here.
You began a discussion a few moments ago in regard to the scales of justice. Why do you believe that the scales of justice tilt in the favor of the position which you are here advocating?
I believe that the scales of justice tilt in favor of our position as it relates to the involvement of the referee, because I think the referee should be given an opportunity to make a recommendation to this court on how the case was tried. And I think that additional information coming to the court is helpful to the court, is beneficial to the court.
One of the objections that I've heard from that in this hearing from members of this bench is that the referee does not, and in past records of the past consideration of these matters, is that the referee at the conclusion of the matter does not know what the cost was, what the bills will be submitted at the end of the referee's most active involvement in the case. What would your response be to that?
I believe we have identified a time frame in the procedure that was previously submitted to the court, which would allow for the submittal of the appropriate information and a response to the information.
In other words, the OLR would have the opportunity to provide the information to the referee, and then the referee would have the opportunity to review that information and make a determination.
That's correct. My final comment, if I may,
yes.
Justice Gableman, is I think it is most important for this court to address the merits of any type of lawyer discipline. If the court can have a referee to provide guidance, it would not be a final decision. The justices, you would have the opportunity to review that. And the State Bar is suggesting that that additional information would be helpful to you in making your decision.
Counselor, the referee is still going to have to apply extraordinary circumstances as the test, if I understand your inner play with Chief Justice Abrahamson, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I know in the past when the court has reduced the fees, it's really been that a lot more was charged than was proven, or in one case, I think two or three counts were charged and stipulated to, and the one that was litigated was not proven. Are extraordinary circumstances then tied to a nexus between the charging of OLR and the proof found by the referee?
It can be tied to the charging decision and what is proven before the referee. It also could be tied to the circumstances of how the case is tried before the referee. That may be a criteria that would convert to extraordinary circumstances. It may be involved in timelines of the proceeding, which is, I think, a case that you've had before. So there are a number of considerations, and I think the referee would be, you're asking the referee to make a very, very difficult recommendation to you with regard to the merits. And that's certainly the seriousness of the proceeding. I think the providing of a recommendation regarding costs would also be a part of that, using my terminology, the closing of the loop of the proceedings before the referee.
Do you envision the referee making findings and applying the extraordinary circumstances test to it and explaining how the two are connected as part of his or her recommendation?
That would be, I would hope and expect that to be the case, some sort of a rationale provided by the referee for a recommendation. I believe that rationale would follow the notion of extraordinary circumstances. Sometimes that doesn't happen in the findings by the referee, but that would be the anticipated process, yes.
Thank you. Are there any other questions of Mr. Diedrich? Justice Prosser.
This is a rule-making matter, as you understand, Mr. Diedrich. It isn't the same as a case. Have you and I ever talked about this subject in, I wouldn't say ever, but have we ever talked about this subject in the last 3 or 4 years?
I'm not sure, Justice Prosser. I have argued this topic before the court in a contested proceeding.
That was Molinaro, wasn't it?
That's correct.
In which you got a unanimous decision to pay less than full costs for your client.
Yes. But I don't recall.
You're complaining about.
There are a number of issues.
What I'm really trying to get at, has any member of the court, but especially me, lobbied the State Bar of Wisconsin Board of Governors or anybody else for a change in the rule?
Not that I'm aware of, Justice Prosser. Nobody has talked to me about changing this rule other than the order that's come before us.
So that when the State Bar of Wisconsin came forward with some suggested amendments to the rule, it did so not under pressure from any member of this court, but because you thought that was the best thing to do. Is that right?
That's correct, Justice Prosser. And I will just indicate to you as background that a member of the Committee on Professional Ethics is Attorney Warren Wood, who was the presenter of this rule back, I think, in 2005. And so I had the benefit of his discussion at our committee meeting about the role of the referee, and that is what prompted the committee to recommend this statement to come back to the court.
Is there a bar committee that is overseeing the operation of the lawyer regulation system?
The Committee on Professional Ethics has assumed the responsibility for that task, as well as its tasks of offering advice to lawyers through written opinions and informal opinions. So that is one of the responsibilities of the Committee on Professional Ethics.
Does that committee deal with other things than the cost issue?
Yes. Very much our function is issuing of formal and informal opinions on the ethics rules.
I've been a member of the Supreme Court since the fall of 1998, and it seems to me one of the first tasks that I participated in was the whole revision of the lawyer regulation system in Wisconsin. And I would say it's probably been in place at least 10 years now, hasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Has there been any discussion in the bar or on the committee that we've just referenced to a need for perhaps a new committee to look at the way the system is working?
The way the lawyer regulation system is working? There has not been discussion of creation of a new committee to investigate or to look at the role and activities of the Office of Lawyer Regulation. Again, the Committee on Professional Ethics views it as part of its charge, because some committees that used to do that have been no longer been filled. So we view that as part of our charge on the Committee on Professional Ethics. But we have not taken up, we have not taken up a specific task at this juncture of looking at the lawyer regulation process in any type of totality.
Is this something that the bar could do?
I'm certain the bar would be able and willing to do that if that would be deemed appropriate.
What are extraordinary circumstances?
Like the scales of justice, I'm not sure that I can give you one precise definition of what are extraordinary circumstances. Some justices have said, I know it when I see it. I think there are a number of things that come into play. Certainly issues regarding how many counts are charged and how many counts are proven. Certainly the focus of a proceeding, a four-day hearing that focuses on one charge for 3.5 days and a half day on three other charges is an extraordinary circumstance, if the first charge is not proven, perhaps. I think those would be circumstances that would be considered extraordinary. Length of time in the process might be a circumstance that would be extraordinary. I'm sure if I sat down for a couple of hours, perhaps with a bottle of wine, I could come up with a definition of extraordinary circumstances. But I think it is subject to a lot of consideration, as each of these cases are unique.
Are you familiar with a recent case, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus Frisch?
I am somewhat familiar from having read it in the past and know that costs were an issue, but I could not recite back to you the factual circumstances.
Well, the facts in this case involved an assistant district attorney in Milwaukee who had some significant alcohol problems. He was charged with 3 different violations. Essentially, he did not contest 2 of the violations. Now, this is not to say that he never put up any resistance at all, but essentially he didn't resist 2 of the violations. The third violation really charged him with misrepresentations, really what is that rule that I'm trying to get at?
Yeah, certainly 20:8.4.
Yes, okay. And the Office of Lawyer Regulation sought his suspension, I believe, for 9 months. I think he argued that he was not guilty of that rule violation and that a 9-month suspension would have been extremely excessive. If I've got the wrong number of months, I'm sure I will be corrected. But for an assistant district attorney, being found guilty of that particular offense and being suspended for the period of time, it might have been 5 months, I just don't remember, would have been devastating. Well, he did not get suspended for the period of time requested, and he was not found guilty by that charge. The referee recommended no costs under these circumstances. The court imposed some costs, and basically the dissent said that the majority was completely irrational, and these were not extraordinary circumstances. If the dissent was correct, then I think there needs to be a definition of extraordinary circumstances. What would be extraordinary if that wasn't extraordinary?
As I've had the opportunity recently to try and address decisions made in the lawyer regulation and discipline system, Your Honor, it is very difficult to provide a clear and succinct answer to a set of facts that have a lot of different components to them. The notion here of what is extraordinary circumstances to some degree is in the eye of the beholder, as I suggested earlier. That is why the State Bar of Wisconsin believes that, first, the referee should have a chance in his or her eyes to make an assessment of extraordinary circumstances. Those set of eyes, that decision, that thinking would be of assistance to you, would be a recommendation to this court, not a decision that this court would have to accept. I think in any case, Justice Prosser, the determination of extraordinary circumstances is not only based on the facts, but it's based upon the eyes of the beholder.
Well, I have a question that's related to that, and especially related to the answer you gave to one of Justice Rogensack's questions, where you would stick with, you advocate here the position that it would start with the extraordinary circumstances being necessary to be present before any deviation from the presumption of full costs being imposed. But then I compare your comments, and I listen carefully to your responses to Justice Prosser's question, and I see you started to list off several of the factors that you are advocating we adopt. My first question is, what's so extraordinary about these factors? And my second is, are you really sticking with the extraordinary circumstances factor, or are you just asking the court to adopt these different considerations for the referee and then ultimately for this court?
The State Bar would be agreeable to continuing the current language that calls for the extraordinary circumstance determination and then the application of the criteria.
So the inquiry would be focused on the factors, and if enough of the factors weigh in favor of mitigation of the reduction of the cost, then that would constitute extraordinary circumstances.
That would be an appropriate way to look at it, yes.
Okay.
Mr. Diedrich, extraordinary is defined in the dictionary as meaning what is beyond what is ordinary and usual. The word means not usually associated with the subject being discussed. So court usually looks to the dictionary. But I'm assuming that if you send this to the referee, that the referee should explain why he or she is imposing full costs or part costs. I'm doing it because here are the extraordinary circumstances. Here are the facts. They are extraordinary, not usual. And the factors in this case that make me apply full costs are, the factors that make me apply part costs are, and then say, and I recommend to the court they impose $1,500, which is what Butch Frisch. And then I'm assuming he explains where he got $1,500 from.
Correct.
That he thinks that the referee respondent should pay full cost for the referee, that the respondent should pay full cost for costs of printing, but should pay only 10% for attorney fees because, or say, I think you should reduce the whole thing 60% across the board. I mean, I'm assuming there'll be some explanation, because that, otherwise, it doesn't help the court at all, right?
That's correct, Chief Justice. I think the first outline you presented probably asks more than what you would get from a referee, but the notion
of... Not if we send it back a couple of times.
That's correct. But certainly the notion of an explanation of how the referee makes that determination is most appropriate, and the informal discussions I've had with referees is that they want to do that.
That's true. I went to, we have an annual meeting of referees. You'll correct me if my memory is wrong here. Usually in connection with the state bar meetings.
Correct.
And I usually go to that meeting. And the thing that you find out about the referees is how seriously they undertake, and properly so, this task. They know they are holding someone's life and livelihood in their hands, at least initially on a recommendation. And they want to do the right thing. And they are given a training on how to make findings of fact, how to make conclusions of law, how to pinpoint it to the accusations, the complaints made, and they are interested in doing costs. They were disappointed when this was taken from them. They think they're in a position to do that if the OLR files the cost there and if the respondent makes specific objections and as to why. I think you're absolutely right on that. From my experience of these annual events, and I can't tell you how many years I've done it, but a lot. So you are absolutely right about that, in my opinion. Are there any other questions for Mr. Dietrich? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
As usual, and I think you should buy an office and a hotel here for the number of times you come and assist the court. And thank you very much on behalf of the court.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Let's see. We now have two appearances marked. Mr. William Weigel of the OLR and Dan Schneidman. Is there anyone else who wishes to appear? All right, Mr. Weigel. I communicated with the staff that OLR should give us information as to the effect of any of changes in the rule as they best sought because of the information they had given us I think it was 2005 when we dealt with this, and I found that very helpful. And Mr. Weigel has handed out this summary. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. And if other people want copies, we'll make additional copies for you. Okay. You
may proceed, counsel. There'll be copies along the back table, Chief and Justices.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, thanks. Good morning. I'm Bill Weigel. I'm litigation counsel for OLR, and I appreciate and thank you for the opportunity to speak OLR's simple and sole agenda in having me appear today is to assist and to serve the court. Got some experience with cost assessment issues. So working under really three different BAPR or OLR directors, I've personally reviewed every objection to cost that has been filed over the past 14 years. I've supervised or written every response our agency has filed, and at your request, or at Keith's, I've spoken to costs about your boards, to your boards, to your referees, and previously to the court. That's the hot-button issue, but it's important to remember that cost assessments and disputes about cost assessments are really simply a derivative, kind of an unintended byproduct of the very hard work of litigating and the very hard work of deciding attorney misconduct actions. And there's many alternate cost assessment models, and those were reviewed and sifted and winnowed by the court some years ago. None is perfect. Each has advantages. Each is quite susceptible of being perceived as unfair in application under some circumstances. And the circumstances of these cases, as the court knows, vary very widely. Back in 2005 and now, I would say and I do say to the court that whether the court would choose a rule or procedure whereby you generally impose full costs, unless the respondent shows extraordinary circumstances, whether you use a mathematical calculation on the number of counts charged and proven and impose a proportion of costs, whether you pick X level of costs for Y level of discipline every time out of the box as being an appropriate way to proceed, you know, which of those court-based methods is up to you? And OLR does not have a horse in that race when the court decides. And we speak today really only because others filed proposals and resubmitted the proposal about the referee making findings about whether OLR met a burden of proof and whether extraordinary circumstances should even be in the mix. They added the burden of proof as to cost items. They added elements such as ability to pay that don't exist in the current rule. And when those proposals were filed, Quite frankly, OLR decided it would best serve the court to appear before you, provide some information, talk about this stuff a little bit. So I'd like to share an observation, and I'd like to discuss several concerns, right, even say deficiencies, with this resubmitted proposal. First observation, the present rule has worked. Today, we provided a summary sheet of some very basic information or statistics about cases that were decided under the current rule. That's a one-page summary. I like one-page summaries. I can keep it all in my mind at one time. But that's painting with a very broad brush. I mean, when it says you agreed with us as far as no cost, that includes 9 dismissal cases. But we certainly agree that if there's going to be a dismissal of an attorney disciplinary proceeding, there should be no costs. If you have any particular questions about them, we'll do our very best to address them. But I think it's a pretty good sheet. And what just strikes me, and I think strikes you, is of all the cases filed in the last 4-plus years, you've decided like 132 of them so far. In all of those, in only one case, was there enough disagreement amongst you all that a dissent was filed on the issue of costs, at least in my recollection, and that's why that was recited in the sheet. Everything might not always be seashells and balloons behind closed doors or maybe in open administrative conferences, but in lawyer regulation decisions, a public expression of unanimity in 131 of 132 decided cases on the issue of costs is remarkable.
Counselor, how would you define extraordinary circumstances? You obviously have been defining
Dietrich
it.
Can have a bottle of wine and come up with the best shot.
Well, I mean, you really, essentially, when there's been an objection to costs, have had to apply that same extraordinary circumstances. How would you define it for us today?
OLR's kind of party line has been to say that generally we don't see extraordinary circumstances in any or many of these cases. We've only kind of asserted it in one case, and I can discuss that as well. We'll say we don't think there's extraordinary circumstances. It's not extraordinary when the preliminary review committee finds cause to proceed and we litigate a charge that a referee decides that the burden was not met. Extraordinary circumstances to me is just a gut issue of fairness when there is a kind of a confluence of factors. In the Frisch case you've talked about, you've got most of the litigation being about one count. That's the hot button, viscerally grabbing count of dishonesty. There were circumstances about what the attorney did and how the attorney conducted himself and his life. And when you put all those together, it looks like members of the court believe that those were extraordinary, and we can understand that.
Well, you know,
we did that too. We punted a case to you in a case, and we said, you know, it just seems a lot more fair to impose 25% of the costs in this case.
If we are to pass, or and I don't know what my colleagues think of this, but if the court were to pass all or some part of the bar's recommendation and have the referee make a recommendation to cost, you will have to argue this issue to the referee. If he's going to make a determination, he's going to have to base it on what you and opposing counsel say, as well as what he's seen himself. He's not going to make it in a vacuum. So I at least see this proposed change as requiring you to argue that. Do you agree or disagree? Maybe I'm on the wrong page.
It would seem the proposed change would put a more significant burden on OLR and would, I think, add to the amount of information brought before the referee in a misconduct proceeding.
Can I just interrupt you for a minute? Sure. I agree with that statement in terms of what the written proposal of the bar was. But Mr. Dietrich said the bar doesn't object to keeping the present standards. They just want it done before the referee first.
Well, it's still the extraordinary circumstances. It's still the test, and that's what I'm inquiring about. You know, you will have to say there are no extraordinary circumstances. Counsel for the attorney that comes before OLR will have to be arguing that there are. So both of you are going to have a more firm understanding of that concept.
I agree. And some of that may... Boy, I've been arguing cases before you for 15 years, and I never have any luck saying, just let me get through my stuff. But I think that some of that may be addressed in a couple of the things that I'd like to talk with you about briefly today as well. Because I do have concerns about the bar's proposal and how it will impact the lawyer regulation process and the work that everybody has to do. You know, and I was saying the present rule has worked. So you got all these cases. You only got the one dissent. And that public unanimity is good, and that consistency, and I'm not lecturing you on this, but that consistency fosters confidence in your lawyer regulation system. The bar did a lot of hard work back in 2005, and I have, as the court does, enormous respect for Dean Dietrich. I have no doubt that he speaks to you with a good heart, and I have enormous respect for the state bar and the good intentions and the good work that they do. This isn't about lobbying or makeup of courts. You know, this is about a fact that there was a sunset provision and then a review was going to be made in the fall of 2010. Now, I can understand how the bar's proposal may have some cachet. It seems to more clearly let you function like a reviewing court, like a court of appeal. But experience provides me with concerns about their proposal. I am here to speak. And Mr. Saleen is having me speak because OLR has concerns about the
proposal.
Now, what's
your concern about it going to the referee? Is that your concern?
Yeah, let's hit four or five of those. If that's adopted, cost recommendations will vary between and amongst referees, sometimes very significantly, even as dissimilarly situated respondents.
That's because you have multiple decision makers.
30, 35
okay.
referees, they're all bringing their stuff to
all
the
right.
table. Now, currently, that imposition of costs by a single court provides some uniformity. Next, the suggested handoff to the referees, this is going to inject cost issues directly into the misconduct hearings, and this will, in many cases, increase the time and expense of litigation. It'll do so, ironically, because of the time expended by respondents and their counsel attempting to argue the burden shifting, attempting to present ability to pay evidence, otherwise avoid cost assessments. Ability to pay, by the way, I mean, I see that as a collection issue, not an assessment issue. But the parties are going to wind up spending time and resources arguing about how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. And when you litigate costs before the referees, that can detract from this truth-seeking process. There will be bleed-overs in focus. The referees do a great job, but just as there will be disparity in recommendations, there will be bleed-overs in focus. What I want to say to the court is there's simply no regulatory payoff to litigating costs. A couple of more clear and less philosophical problems. Many disciplinary cases involve appeals from the report of the referee. The bar's proposal, I don't believe, accounts for appeals. I don't believe their proposal will save you work. The court would still have to wrestle on its own with the propriety of imposing full or partial or no appellate costs. The court would still have to wrestle with the propriety of adopting or rejecting or modifying the various and unique referee recommendations you're going to get as to trial costs. And here is an issue.
Counsel, what number are you on?
Pardon me?
What number are you on?
I'm somewhere around three or four.
Okay.
It's, you're going to get variance.
you're
going to get variance. It's going to add to the work. Yeah. There's going to be a bleed over in focus. There's an appeal issue, and it's not going to save the court work. Kind of put that together. I guess we'll call that number four. I got five fingers or four fingers and a thumb here. The last one. Costs objections filed by respondents frequently dispute the time and expenses of the referee. This is the case in several disciplinary cases you have pending before you right now. For a good example of this in a reported past decision, see the McNeely case, which came out in 2008. I scribbled down, it was paragraphs 27-28. I mean, I ask rhetorically, should referees decide cost objections that dispute referees' bills?
They reduce it, maybe that'll... Well, they'll get paid anyway. It's
they only get paid $55 an hour. I don't think they want to reduce themselves a lot.
Well, but maybe it's not – it doesn't reduce your expenses. The OLR is going to have to pay the referee. It doesn't say the OLR doesn't pay the referee. What it does is it says the respondent will only pay 50% of the referee bill, but you're going to have to pay the other 50%, which means the members of the state bar will pay the 50%.
The respondent is arguing, Madam Referee, your bill is unfair, you spend too much time, you're
saying
biased,
that there's an interest
and I object
here.
To that, and then the referee is supposed to put on the judge hat and decide that. You're right, it will not affect the amount of money that comes out of OLR's
check. Like the municipal judge who used to get paid by the case. That's what you're saying.
Well, the referee is going to get paid regardless, as you point out, but it's an unseemly adjudication.
Got it. It increases the cost. That's what it does to the parties, because they got to fight it at the referee and they got to fight it here.
You know, it might. I would like to think, and I believe that this isn't about $3 here or even $6 there, although I know that that adds up and it is an important consideration in this economy and to the bar. You know, the current rule, it requires the court and it requires your commissioners to do some original lifting. But you're going to have to lift and decide. And sending it to the referees for a while isn't going to result in some kind of a sea change if you adopt this resubmitted bar proposal. And in fact, I think that I've given you some reasons, at least, that proposal carries with it significant peril of making things worse. By contrast, what you have works. This current procedure provides adequate due process. Talk about scales of justice. These materials are very susceptible of a paper review. Out of all the cases, there are only a couple where you disagreed with our request for full costs, and in one of those, Mr. Dietrich's case, you were unanimous. I'm not sure. I think the referee had perhaps recommended far more costs than you imposed in that matter.
I don't have
it. It ain't broke. Don't fix it. And if you have questions, I or Keith are very happy to respond to them.
I have a question.
Go ahead.
If we adopt the proposal of the state bar, how will you define extraordinary circumstances?
Well, I will follow whatever the court defines extraordinary circumstances. I
really am back to my first premise. I'm trying to weigh what they've said to us with our past practices. And it seems to me if this matter is going to be put before the referee and the referee is going to make a finding and the referee is going to say why he made the finding, you're going to have a pretty good idea more than just a gut feeling, which is what I think you said to me before, because you know that kind of an argument isn't going to get you very far. You've got to have a better perception of what of why you think these are not extraordinary circumstances. I know to some degree you'll bounce off of whatever the bar representation says are extraordinary circumstances. But I'm just wondering if it's something that you've thought about in line with this proposal that's before us.
Well, OLR has only argued to you that there should be a reduction of costs in one case. Again, it was a private reprimand case, and quite frankly, we made a mistake in not strictly applying the court's rule. Maybe we punted the question to you. We said, well, it's not really extraordinary. It's not extraordinary that we lose counts, but there's this confluence of what the referee felt and what our counsel was able to apportion his time to the particular count, and it felt very fair, and that's why we recommended in that single case out of these 132. It's not extraordinary you lose counts. It's not extraordinary that there are going to be significant consequences to an attorney's life from the imposition of discipline. It's not extraordinary that there are horrendous discovery disputes and in some cases even interlocutory appeals. There aren't a lot of, I guess, extraordinary circumstances in these cases. I will say, Justice, that talked about painting with a broad brush in that one-page summary. I mean, there are circumstances. There's a cost statement I signed and filed within the last week where we said, you know, the referee charged another small amount because she reviewed the appellate briefs, and we're not going to seek to assess that. I mean, it just wouldn't seem fair or right to assess that unnecessary cost upon the respondent, although we reported to you that it was incurred because we always report the costs. There was another matter. It's a public case, the Osika case. where the referee made a recommendation and it wasn't consistent with what the court does. It recommended a 30-day suspension, brought a motion for reconsideration, briefed the issue a little bit, and we told the court, you know, we spent money on that, but the $350 we spent on that, don't charge the respondent for that. That's not his fault. So I guess one answer is that, and I'm sorry that I'm deferring back to when it seems fair, but there have been circumstances in which OLR has felt it's not necessary to lockstep impose every penny. We will just report them and tell you when we're not and why we're not. And the court's gone along with those recommendations as well.
What's the matter with just using the dictionary definition of extraordinary? It says...
not ordinary.
Beyond what is ordinary. That's right. So it's not extraordinary to have some counts not proved. It's not extraordinary that there be a fight about discovery. But as you said, when you get a confluence of circumstances in one case, then you might have extraordinary circumstances. Or if you have what is extraordinary, the number of counts and the number of counts that aren't proved or are dismissed, you got 18 and you only get to one and it happens to be the least important one and you get a private reprimand, you got a problem. That's a confluence of circumstances that makes that case not ordinary, not usually associated with OLR cases. So I don't know why you're struggling.
I'm struggling because I came to tell the court some things I think you should think about and some real problems with the bar's proposal. I was not adequately prepared to assist the court by trying to define extraordinary circumstances.
Well, here I am trying to help you, and you're not taking it.
Doing a great job, all of you.
As usual, as you're supposed to say.
Okay.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Yes.
Okay.
Counsel, one of your first points was the bar's proposal cost issues will be injected into the misconduct and add to the work. That's one of your earlier comments. And I just want to make sure that I'm clear with regard to what the bar's proposal is. As I understand it, within 20 days of the filing of the referee's report. So the referee has decided the issue of misconduct. Then the Office of Lawyer Regulation is to submit a statement of costs. And there can be an objection filed by the respondent, and there can be a reply filed by OLR. And then the referee is to make a decision based on the written submissions, and there will not be an opportunity for any further discovery or any further hearing. If the referee's decision is appealed, it comes to the court, there are appellate costs that are incurred, and again, after a time period, there will be appellate costs submitted, opportunity for objection, and a decision by this court. So if the costs are not to be filed until within 20 days or within 20 days of the filing of the referee's report, that means after the referee's report is already filed, as I anticipated. But maybe I'm wrong. That's why I'm asking you for clarification. I want to know how you anticipate this procedure with the referee to unfold under the bar's proposal and why it injects into this misconduct, the issue of costs, under their procedure. Is my question clear enough?
Yes. If I am wearing a different hat, if I am respondents' counsel and making those big bucks that Mr. Dietrich and Mr. Schneidman make, I am going to inject into the proceedings evidence and opinion and briefing about the severity, about the nature of the misconduct. I'm going to subpoena or produce evidence and witnesses about the respondents' cooperation or lack of cooperation at every stage of the process. Sure, there's a non-cooperation count here in count five, but in June of 2006 he did this and then he did that and he did letters, and it would add that cumulative information would come into the record. I'm going to inject information about the respondents' ability to pay, and I'm going to probably besmirch my worthy opponent from OLR if he or she is trying to subpoena bank records to show information about ability to pay or is disputing what I'm putting forth. There's going to be a lot of contentious arguments that are hitting close to home, and I would think that the litigants would want that in the record so that after the hearing is done, after the misconduct is recommended or decided by the referee, when it comes time to file the costs and argue about costs, you got something to argue about.
That I didn't think about that. That makes sense. If I were sitting as a circuit court judge and an issue of costs had arisen after the proceeding was decided, then there would be a hearing on costs, and at that hearing, there would be these things advanced into evidence or argument, as you're suggesting, you know, maybe overkill on something or ability to pay or this nature, severity, blah, 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 blah. That would come in the circuit court in a hearing after the costs are filed and objection. But an objection was made and the court would set a hearing. But you're indicating to me, and this helps, thank you, that because there's no hearing, not that you want another hearing before a referee, but a consequence of not having a hearing on costs pursuant to the objection filed for costs is that will be anticipatorily litigated in the misconduct proceeding itself. That's what you're saying.
That's what I'm saying. And we, you know, respectfully, we don't need the work. I mean, we're stretched a little bit thin as it is doing the work of addressing misconduct cases. And again, I just don't think there's the regulatory payoff. It maybe goes back to the point about the paper review. This is basically an accounting of what the fourth floor of the Tenney building paid out in behalf of OLR in disciplinary cases. And the paper review works, and I'm sorry that I'm not recalling which justice said, you know, the criteria that the court has under the current rule allows the court to make a decision. I just think you're going to add a lot into the mix, and it's not going to be worth it.
I thought you were thinking that the referee would say, okay, it's a close call on this count. I'm going to say it hasn't been proven, but I'll suck them with the costs. Or it's a close call, I'm going to say violation, but we won't suck them with the costs.
Yeah, I mean, that can have some kind of a subtle impact. I think I called it a bleed over in focus, but I mean, we have confidence, and you do and should have confidence in the decisions of your referees in deciding misconduct. I'd like to think they're not going to throw a misconduct count one way or the other because they have a visceral feeling about imposition of costs. But
any other questions?
Yeah.
Justice Prosser.
When OLR has a consensual public or private reprimand, do you always impose full costs?
We never do, but let me define that. Under SCR 2209, OLR can enter into a proposed consent reprimand agreement with a respondent that is provided to a court referee, and the court referee approves it and imposes that reprimand or rejects it. The question was asked prior to the hearing about absorption of costs or something, and I guess those are costs we absorb. There's a policy that the OLR has developed where we don't impose those costs in 2209 cases ever. In fact, we don't impose investigative costs. Something can get investigated for 4 years. The meter starts running, as it were, when the litigation person has the file, drafts a complaint, and the public case is up and rolling. When there is a stipulation between the parties in a publicly filed case, as a matter of policy, we've reported the cost to the court, but said don't impose those. If somebody's waving the white flag and entering into a comprehensive stipulation as to the misconduct and the sanction under SCR 22.12, and there have been a lot of those, we don't seek to have those imposed. Generally, once it hits a referee, we're going to seek to have costs imposed. There are only a couple of deviations from that. The court in the first decision mentioned the Young case. I mean, that's a guy who just wasn't coming to the table until there was a referee appointed. And then he came in and said, I'm going to stip. And we said, okay, fine, let's do it a no-cost thing. There was another stipulation that was kind of similarly situated that's within that summary sheet. Does that answer your question, Justice?
Do you impose costs in reciprocal discipline cases?
We seek to have costs imposed in reciprocal and discipline cases, again, unless there's a 2212 stipulation that's entered into and then approved by the court, and then we ask the court not to impose costs.
2212 is what?
It's the procedure whereby the parties can enter into a comprehensive stipulation before a referee gets involved as to all the misconduct and as to the sanction, and so we lay it out to the court and ask for the court's approval of that.
What if there's a default? They just don't show up. Reciprocal, default.
In default proceedings, we've sought to impose costs, but the nature of every default proceeding, there's going to be a referee appointed.
Okay.
And so we click into that rule, and we got to do the work. I mean, so it seems appropriate that the court's adopted a rule where the miscreant pays the costs of the proceedings.
There are times, other than 2209, where you do not impose costs, notwithstanding a determination of misconduct. Is that right?
Well, 2209 is the consent thing. Let's say it happens over there at our offices. You folks never see it. 2212 is a comprehensive stipulation in a publicly filed case. Now, maybe it's publicly filed because it's a suspension case, and that's not something that Keith can enter into a consent agreement on without you looking at it and deciding. So there's 2209, there's 2212, and there's been just one or two cases in which there has been a stipulation, even after a referee, where we've said we're not going to seek to impose costs.
You view that as a discretionary matter in your office? Whether to impose
yeah, I
costs.
Mean, yes, it's something that we talk about, and then Keith makes the decision because it's really skirting up to a policy type decision. Yeah.
Well, when you have a 2209 case, as I understand it, there is full authority on the part of the director to assess full or partial costs of investigation and any other costs, I would think.
I believe that's correct. I have not looked at that rule in a while, but yes, I think that there is rule authority for us to assess costs or seek to assess costs of those.
Okay.
We just don't do it when there's this pre-suit consent.
What
at reprimand level.
What is the authority of the Office of Lawyer Regulation not to impose full costs in any other situation?
Well, we don't impose costs, and I'm not trying to split hairs. We seek an assessment of costs, and we ask the court, and the court thinks about it and imposes costs or not. Under the Rule 2224, it says if the OLR director is seeking an assessment of costs, we file the statement and the explanation and the recommendation.
It doesn't quite answer my question. There are situations other than 2209 in which OLR does not assess costs, but a finding of misconduct has been made.
Yes.
What's the authority for that?
I would have to look closely at 2224, but I believe it. Hang on a moment, please. I'm sorry. I'll put it that way, but let me try to find that rule. What I'm inclined to answer, without having my fingers on the rule, Justice Prosser, is I don't know that there is a mandatory seeking of the assessment of costs.
The court's general policy is that upon a finding of misconduct, it is appropriate to impose all costs, including the expenses of counsel for the Office of Lawyer Regulation.
Thank you. 2224, the Supreme Court may assess against the respondent all or a portion of the cost of a disciplinary proceeding. That's in sub 1 and sub 2.
Well, listen, read the second sentence of 22.24. The director may assess all or a portion of the costs when discipline is imposed under 2209. Okay, go ahead.
The court has a general policy to impose all costs. We are not required to seek all costs. We report all costs of the proceeding to the court, and we make a recommendation. Sometimes that recommendation is for less than full costs or for no costs. If we say Attorney Smith entered into a 2212 stipulation, here it is packaged up, here's the misconduct, 60-day suspension, we're suggesting no costs because he entered into this agreement from the get-go and there wasn't even a referee. But by the way, the costs are $600. The court is certainly free to say we're going to assess $600. I'm not trying to duck the question. I'm trying to answer it in terms of as a practical matter, how we process and how you process these things.
It just seems to me the language of the rule, the court's general policy is that upon a finding of misconduct, it is appropriate to oppose all costs, including the expenses of counsel for the Office of Lawyer Regulation. That is supposed to be a statement of policy. Now, what the policy is within the office, I think often makes very, very good sense. That's not my point. But I want to know what your authority is, other than under 2209, to depart from this general statement of the court's policy. Because I'm hearing from some members of the court that we should never deviate from that policy, and that's essentially what you're saying. So why can you do something we can't do?
We can't do anything you can't do, pretty much, but we we make a recommendation, you know, and a recommendation regarding the costs. And I guess if you're saying, how can we ever in the 2212 stipulation ask the court to agree that no cost should be imposed, I guess implied in that decision that the court is making, we're saying find these to be extraordinary circumstances. Or an attorney has said right away from the get-go, I agree to all of the misconduct found by the PRC that the OLR is charging. I agree to the exact sanction that Mr. Celine is seeking. There's no plea bargaining. I'm waving the white flag. And what do we say? Oh, thanks a lot. You know, it took Bob Crone 3 hours to draft the complaint, so you're still going to owe us a few $100. I guess it's somewhat extraordinary when somebody does that is one way to try to answer that question, but I really don't want to tread very deeply into the minefield of what the court's policy is and whether it's applying it properly.
Well, what do you do? I'm going to phrase Justice Prosser's question as I understand it differently. When do you waive or reduce costs that the court does not see and approve it, other than 2209? In 2212, the court has to approve the stipulation, so it sees whether the costs are reduced. So where do you do costs without the court seeing it?
If we incur...
I think that's your question. Isn't that your question, Justice Prosser? Okay.
I'm sorry. If we incur cost expenditures, we are going to report those in litigation, and costs are defined under 22.001. I don't recall the subsection right now. We are going to report those costs to the court. And when might we... What don't we report? What do we absorb?
What do you absorb? What do you waive? And the court never sees it. That's what we're talking about.
Support time, secretarial time. We don't.
Well, but that's not part of the costs.
If,
the costs are defined here in specifics, and it's not part of the cost for secretarial help.
Okay.
And that's not generally costs that are given in any litigation. Cost is defined in subsection 3, compensation and necessary expenses of referees, fees and expenses of counsel for OLR, reasonable disbursement for service of process, amounts actually paid for certified copies, postage, telephone, adverse examinations and depositions, expert witness fees and expenses, compensation and reasonable expenses of experts and investigators employed on a contractual, not in your office, but on a contractual basis, and any other costs and fees authorized by 814, which is the general cost and fees. So secretaries are not put in.
Right. If trying to think of what do we absorb and not report to you? If all of my time, for instance, if it's being handled by somebody else in the office or by a retained counsel, we put a significant amount. I guess you could say that I, or at least Keith, is counsel for the Office of Lawyer Regulation. We don't try to pass those costs along. There's one prosecutor.
I know. That isn't what Justice Prosser is asking you. So he's asking a rather simple question. As to those costs covered in 22.0013, which you would ordinarily pass on in a matter, when do you waive or reduce them without the court seeing them? Now, 2209 is one. You're fighting the question. I think your answer is you don't do it.
We don't. Yeah, we
I think
don't
that's
do
your
it.
Answer.
I'm struggling to find costs that you don't maybe know about, and I'm thinking we don't do it. We report our expenditures to the court, and even when the referee charged $27 to read a brief and got paid, we told you about it. And we said, please don't assess that cost against this
respondent. Right, because you're authorized under the statute to make a recommendation. So you're authorized under the statute to say no costs when you come here. You could. Or you could say one half, one fourth, or full. We're trying to, I think that's your point of your question, right?
The point of my question is I see clear authority to impose 100% of the costs or less in 2209. I don't see authority in the rule to deviate from 2224.1M in any other situation. Now, this is not to say that you shouldn't do it. I think you should do it.
Well, what about sub 2? Justice Prosser, in seeking the assessment of costs by the Supreme Court, directors shall file a statement of costs after the 20 days, together with a recommendation to the court regarding the costs to be assessed against the respondent. I think that's what they're working under. They give their full costs under 22001, but they can say, pay them only half. That's how I read together a recommendation to the court regarding the costs to be assessed.
And that rule as well says our recommendation should explain why the particular amount of costs is being sought.
That's the following sentence. The recommendation should explain why the particular amount of costs is being sought.
Which we do.
But it seems to me that there's no establishment, these are extraordinary circumstances when you do that. To me, this is simple double standard, an ambiguity in the rule. And my real question is, shouldn't this rule be clarified? And over the last 10 years, have you seen the need, and are you considering any other rule changes?
We adopted this rule, and we began reporting on costs and making a recommendation. It was often a one-liner. The OLR director recommends that blank amount of costs or full costs be assigned. And at a luncheon meeting with a number of persons present, it became clear to OLR, it was December of 2008, that that was not serving the court as well as we could and providing enough information. And so the manner in which we presented that information changed. We did a formatting change internally and began discussing, began addressing whether we believe there were extraordinary circumstances and even addressing all of the factors should the court find that there were to be. I'm listening to you, Justice Prosser, and again, I don't want to go past each other, and thinking maybe what OLR should be doing in a situation of 2212 stipulation or a situation where a referee does a little extra work, respond, and shouldn't be charged with, it should be articulating in our cost statement, we think this is an extraordinary circumstance, and the respondent should not be charged this particular cost or these costs of drafting the complaint. And that would provide the court with that information, that recommendation that would, I guess you'd say, justify imposing no costs if that's what the court chooses to do. Now, you may need a rule change. You may just need to tell us to give you better information.
That's not quite what I'm getting at. I don't think that this needs to be an extraordinary circumstance for you to do this. I think there might need to be some clear authority for you to do it. It seems to me Supreme Court Rule Chapter 22 has been in place for about 10 years, maybe more than 10 years now. And I'm wondering if it is time for a review to see if everything is working the way it ought to work or whether we could make some improvements in the procedure.
I understand. It's been 10 years and 3 days.
Mr. Weigel, there's a Board of Administrative Oversight. Is that functioning well? That's supposed to be in constant review, generally, of your processes. Do you report?
The Board of Administrative Oversight meets quarterly. It functions pursuant to the rules. It monitors the fairness and efficiency of the system. They review reports and information and request information about various aspects of the process. For several years, 7, 8, 9 years ago, they were concerned with and reporting to the court about district committees functioning. More recently, they were thinking about a sanction issue and have proposed something to the court with regard to that. You ask me if they work well. They always meet and they're quite engaged. And further affiance saith not.
Are there changes in the code that proposed by the ABA that we should be looking at?
I'm sorry.
Are there changes proposed by the American Bar Association for the Code of Professional Responsibility, which we have adopted with adaptations, that we should be looking at?
I'm a drone. I'm not the director, but I think that that certainly were Keith standing here next to me, sometimes this morning, I wish he had been, he'd say we're always reviewing. We're always trying to do it better, to do the right thing, but to find out where our deficiencies are and to identify those and to work to make the lawyer regulation system better. And those sound like highfalutin words, but it's so very important. And so, sure, we and the board work well to try to do those things, whether on a continuous introspective basis or whether the court believes it's appropriate to have some kind of a study.
And the court meets with the OLR staff annually.
Yes. Right?
And is a question always asked, how can we improve this? Where should we be making changes, either in efficiency or quality or both?
I think that's always the topic of concern and conversation, and Keith traditionally reports to the court about what's happening and some of the initiatives that are being considered or thought about to improve. Yes.
All right. Are there any other questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Weigel. And I have promised myself that when we sit for an hour and a half to 2 hours, that the court takes the seventh inning stretch. So if you'd all stand. And I'm going to call on Mr. Schneidman. Mr. Schneidman, court has received your material. Would you take the podium? The court has received your materials. You've heard the discussion, so I'd appreciate, and the court would appreciate, because I want to complete not only this, but I want to complete 10:07 before the court breaks for lunch. Got it? So
I understand thoroughly.
All right. If you don't mind, can you talk to people who are standing as well as those who are sitting?
Which way are you going to ask less questions?
Don't worry about it. Just keep talking.
Okay. All right.
Thank you.
If I may, I'll try to address some of the questions raised by the justices with Justice Prosser. The State Bar of Wisconsin formed a committee called the OLR Review Committee prior to the OLR coming into official existence. That committee had been studying all of the rules and some of the proposed rules. We had a subcommittee dealing with the cost issue, and we had a special committee on solo and small firm practices. Madam Chief, two questions been asked. Would you give us the percentages or the data on solo and small firm practitioners, and give us data on who's representing the majority of the respondents? You would find that in 2005 and for several years thereafter, the percentages of between 75% and 80%. Of the respondents that you eventually rule upon are solo and small firm practitioners, and about 75% to 80% of them are unrepresented. So to the extent OLR and my good friend Bill Weigel says, if it ain't broke, it's fixed, I have a different opinion. If you have that consistently year after year, individuals from small firms at that larger percentage, that isn't what I think a justice system should have for lawyers. They're respondents, and they have violated the rules. But keep in mind, and I think one of the speakers said that the amount of the money is a significant issue, not only that their ability to pay or what it may mean to their personal and professional futures, it's a message that you send to the new lawyers who may have a difficulty with OLR that they can't afford a lawyer. They can't afford to fight. These are litigated cases. That committee, Justice Prosser, was eliminated by the incoming president about 3 years ago made that decision. It was not with our consent that the subcommittee.
Mr. Schneidman, we have also observed that many people that come before OLR are from small firms. Does the State Bar have any kind of a program for those people who operate solo and in small firms to help them set up in-office procedures so that they are able to perhaps have less problems with rule compliance?
Well, I believe several years ago the State Bar did suggest the operation of a mentor committee. I know they've taken stages with the State Bar and their technical help, and the president of the State Bar, and George Brown, would be more apt to answer that question adequately. Mentoring does help. But keep in mind that the solo is all by him or herself. They're lucky if they have a secretary or a legal assistant. And the small firms don't have the people power to apply all of the rules. But that isn't why we're here today. Madam Chief, I was surprised why, as I read 22.16, empowers the Supreme Court appointed referees with all powers of a judge trying a civil action. That's our present rule. That's been our rule for 10 years. I do quite a bit of work, not as the litigator in statutory fee-shifting statutes. You have ruled in those decisions very clearly on what you do if the plaintiff in those cases wins on the merits of what if there were violations of either the labor cases or their advertising cases or any of the consumer cases. If the plaintiff wins that, the judge simply says, "Okay, we're going to talk about the attorney fees." And I, frankly, Your Honor, thought that that would my proposal, which also is the state bar's proposal, and that the referee is the judge who sits and hears how that case was tried, who sits and hears what about the charges that were issued by OLR or the plaintiff, and how has the respondent or the defendant proved their defense of that? Now, when the court has seemed to spend a lot of time this morning on what's the unusual circumstances, I think that's conclusionary. I think there's a myriad of factors that we could spend, I know we're not going to, but we could spend hours talking about unusual circumstances. My opinion, for the little that it's worth, if you were to read the referee's five pages, pages 40 to 45, the referee's decision or the recommendations to the court, she did not berate OLR. She simply listed five pages of allegations that were part of a third count and simply said there was no evidence. There just was no evidence. Now, I don't know if the referee was implicating that, and she didn't utter the words, that the charges against Frisch were overcharged. I think that's what she could have said what she said in the last shorter word. And I think she was sending a message to the court that should have never been issued. Now, the question I came to my mind is when does the duty of clear, convincing, and satisfactory burden by OLR to prove, is that at the time of the issuance of the complaint that's filed with the Supreme Court, or is it at the time when the trial is over? Or when the trial begins and when the trial is over. And as I read her decision, it was never there. The business about the misrepresentation. Sorry.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
With a short time, I want to focus you.
Okay.
What exactly do you want changed in the rules?
I want to just simply say where OLR makes the recommendation on the fees, I'm saying that the referee shall.
Okay. Leave the same standards now?
I think I may have modified something that is
so
not...
You have modified severity.
Yes.
And yes. The charge. But
yes.
Those are good verbal changes, but don't go to the guts of the
correct
issue. I think you'll agree with me on
yes
that.
Yes.
All right. So you, like Mr. Diedrich, wanted to go to the referee, the
yes
issue of cost, and then reviewed by this court.
Yes.
You don't object to the present standard of extraordinary circumstances and then the list?
No, I think it's difficult to interpret, but I wanted to assuage the court that it's not impossible. I'm saying the way the referee in the Frisch case, in my opinion, was sending the message to you that these charges should never, excuse me, charge three should never have been made.
Okay. Well, let's not refight the Frisch
okay
case.
Okay.
Were you counsel in that case?
I was a consultant, Your Honor.
Okay. You won it 4-3, let it go.
Pardon me?
I said you won it 4-3,
well,
let it go.
Your Honor, it's just one.
I understand.
Yes, it's one case.
I understand.
Let me just see if there's anything.
For edification, it's presented in our material, so the court had an opportunity to reread it. Simply presented in the
Okay. Well, Your Honor, I did just as a hopefully as a joke. I was going to send you all. All one short letter that said I haven't read a case where both the majority and the dissent got it right. But that's what I really thought happened. Okay.
The dissent is very pleased.
Pardon me?
The dissent is very pleased with your comment. The majority is not.
Okay.
All right. So you agree with the bar?
Yes.
Referee should get the issue of costs first.
Yes.
Before the court, after the decision is made on the misconduct.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And maintain the standards we put in 2005
yes.
or 2006. Okay.
Yes. Very truly,
summary for you?
Very truly yours.
All right, very true. Thank you very much, and thank you. You have been a very loyal, observant, and participant in OLR matters, both as counsel and in critiquing the court's rules, and we do appreciate it because not everyone is willing to take the time and make the effort to keep on top of these issues, which affect only a small percent of the bar. I think it's, 0.2% are ever involved in the grievance procedure.
Thank you.
Are there any questions? No. All right. Does anyone else want to appear on 05-01 relating to cost assessments? We usually give the proponent, and here it's a little odd because we're dealing with a review, a chance to speak. Does anyone from the bar wish to speak? Thank you. Oh, you do? No. Okay. Thank you. The bar does not wish to speak. That closes our hearing on 0501 in the matter of review of amendments to Supreme Court Rule 22.24 relating to cost assessments in the lawyer regulation system. So we will open up the Rules Petition 1007 in the matter of the petition to amend Supreme Court Rules 1206, 12.02 sub 6, and 12.03 sub 7 concerning the Lawyers Assistance Corporation. Mr. Bowell, are you up first?
May it please the Court. Madam Chief Justice and members of the Court. My name is Jim Bowl, and I'm the President of the State Bar of Wisconsin. And on February 26th, by unanimous vote, the State Bar of Wisconsin Board of Governors approved the petition that is before the Court today that proposes that the Lawyer Assistance Corporation be removed from the rules and that the State Bar, the corporation's sole member, be authorized to dissolve the corporation. I'm honored today to introduce Attorney Ferris Horton to outline the State Bar's position. Mr. Horton is a sole practitioner in Madison and now in emeritus status. He's been an active member of the State Bar, particularly adding his expertise to real property, probate, and trust law sections, and to attorney regulation matters. Mr. Horton is a member of the American College of Real Estate Attorneys and is an affiliate with the Realtors Association of South Central Wisconsin and Madison Area Builders. He received the U.S. Small Business Administration Legal Advocates Year Award and the Wisconsin Realtors Association Distinguished Service Award in 2001. He's a graduate of Georgetown Law School and served in the late 50s as a congressional aide to a Missouri congressman. On behalf of the 24,000 members of the State Bar of Wisconsin, I'm pleased and honored to introduce Attorney Ferris Horton to represent the State Bar's position on this matter.
Thank you, Mr. Bowell. Attorney Horton.
May it please the Court, Madam Chief Justice, members of the Court. I'm pleased to see that you're sitting. My colleagues would never believe it if I said the Chief Justice rose to hear my comments.
Well, I stand, and then I'm going to be seated, partially because I think this is the first petition in all my years on the bench where someone wants to dissolve something and get rid of it and saying it's gone instead of adding to the bureaucracy. So I don't want to be too shocked, so I will be seated. Mr. Horton.
Appropriate, Your Honor. I am appearing in support of the bar's petition as the president of the Lawyers Assistance Corporation, which I will hasten to point out is not the Lawyers Assistance Program, separate item, right, internal to the bar.
Thank you.
Back in the early 90s, there was a discussion in this state and others about what to do in the case of an attorney who becomes dysfunctional. How do you provide for the protection of the clients of that particular attorney? In 1993, this court gave an order to create the Lawyers Assistance Corporation. In 1994, that corporation was created. We did not have what you would call a tsunami of need that had overwhelmed the state of Wisconsin, nor nationally. This was a proactive idea that since this might occur, it would be well to have something in place for it. In the discussion of it in this state, we came up with a particular focus, and that focus was the solo practitioner, deceased, disabled, or disappeared. Other states had a broader outlook on it. But the whole idea was, how do you meet this potential problem? And the structure that was established for this state, as I say, was the Lawyers Assistance Corporation. And the need for a separate monument was that there had to be an entity through which the trustee attorneys, those who were appointed to take over the practice or to work with the practice of the disappeared, deceased, or disabled attorney, could obtain malpractice insurance. The whole predicate of this separate corporation was the need for that entity. As mentioned, there was no tsunami of problem that came up, and in fact, it is a situation that is very infrequent. Operationally, we have found in the state of Wisconsin, these situations where they have arisen have been handled pretty much on an ad hoc basis. The procedure that appears in the rules has not been implemented in these cases. Rather, a local judge, a local bar association, a community of lawyers has gotten together to take care of the problem.
Usually under the OLR, right?
The OLR is definitely involved with it, but not necessarily purely through the OLR, because frequently there are no
problems,
prosecution,
right,
problems, right, that have arisen as yet.
But somebody dies or is incapacitated, yes, and the files have to be taken over, right?
Correct. And in this situation, the state bar has cooperated and has financially assisted the trustee attorneys where they have encountered expenses. For example, in the storage of files. This has run in one case, as I recall it, to $2,000 to $3,000. Excuse me, $20,000 just to store, go through. The volunteer work was done in going through these files, but to collect them, find a place for them, get through them, notify the clients, see what the status was, notify the judiciary, and try to work the problem through. As I say, the state bar has cooperated with it. The state bar has also maintained a malpractice policy. $2,000 to $3,000 a year on that.
It's not the coverage, that's the premium.
That's the premium, yes. There have been no trustees that have been covered by it. And in a 1997 letter to the court, by attorney John Wiley, who was deeply involved in the creation and the operation of the corporation in its earlier stage, it was noted that this wasn't necessary. And this is one of the points that I will raise. It is not necessary. You do not need to have this separate entity to have the, quote, employer position for the malpractice insurance. In checking with malpractice insurers, primarily Wilmick, Wisconsin Lawyers Mutual, they say you're covered for trustee functions already.
My understanding is that, I think there was something in our file that very few, if any, lawyers have gone through this issue.
That is correct.
There's only one or so over the years.
If one, I don't have the records on it, but it has been very, very infrequently mentioned, much less called upon.
And the functions are now being taken over by the Lawyer Assistance Program and OLR.
To some extent, Chief Justice.
It's taken over by somebody, otherwise you wouldn't be here.
It is done primarily on this ad hoc basis.
All right.
It has not vested itself in OLR necessarily or in WISLAP, which is more directed toward the impaired physician than the deceased. Really impaired when you're deceased, but you don't get
we don't,
that.
We don't know that. We don't know that.
It's a presumption that I'm operating
okay.
under.
All right.
I wouldn't be so risky if I
right.
were you.
State Bar of Wisconsin. Adam Corbett sent a memo to Teresa Owens and indicated that from 2001 through the 10, 1, 2, 3, 4, 6, 7, 10, 13 people over a period of 10 years might have been employees of the LAC, but
yes,
no longer
but,
needed.
But okay. None of them followed the procedure for appointment as a trustee.
Here's my question.
Yes.
Why don't you just leave this corporation there and die on the vine? Don't file any annual reports with the, I'm not suggesting you ought to do this, but Secretary of State, why come in and ask for you have to file this complicated procedure with us to dissolve it. Why do you want it dissolved? I understand that it's not being used, but why dissolve it?
Well,
officially and formally.
Because the court ordered that it exist.
Okay.
And the court gave it certain functions.
All right.
We feel that to the extent it is an appendix on the body politic.
Okay.
We would ask that there be the court's permission, since it was your creation, for us to do away with it. Certainly, we should do away with the requirement that it maintain malpractice insurance, since it's not needed.
Okay. $2,000. Justice Bradley.
I have a question. Is there any function for this appendix on the body politic in this regard? There are in counties around the state, circumstances when an attorney dies or disappears, more a solo practitioner, the court then appoints someone locally some attorney to protect the client's rights, to notify the clients, to deliver clients' files, to collect outstanding attorney's fees, to assist and cooperate with other stuff. And yet there's not money for the attorney trustee to be compensated. Where is the money coming from? If there's enough money in the generated in connection with the winding down the operation, that's one thing. But if there isn't, then the judges need a source of money to pay an attorney who's doing all of this work. So does this corporation have any function to play with regard to that kind of fact situation?
This is an excellent question, Justice. No, we don't have any money. No, we don't have any way to raise money. In the situations that have occurred in the past, it has been a pro bono effort, and in some cases a pro bono effort mounting into the thousands of dollars by an interested and willing practitioner.
I would venture to guess that it's a pro bono effort, maybe going into the tens of thousands of dollars. If you're dealing with an active solo practitioner who dies, I mean, that's a running law office. That's more than just a few hours of attention, it seems to me.
We agree wholeheartedly with you, Justice. That is one of the problems that, for which we have no solution. We have been in contact with the senior lawyers section, which would appear to be the ones that might have the best capabilities and availabilities to function in this, to unwrap this Gordian knot. And they have been very cooperative, but it has been on this informal basis. Either the local, frequently the state bars, programs will come into contact with it to help move things forward. Our procedure in the corporation is not the procedure that anyone has ever used.
And there's no function of the corporation to address this issue, at least as I saw in the statutes.
I lead perhaps the most functionless corporation on the globe.
I hope you get a big salary.
Oh, it is unbelievable.
And a pension plan.
Yes. That golden parachute is truly something to observe. But basically we are recommending that the rule be adopted, that number one, the malpractice insurance function be stripped, which is the lined out portion of the rule, and that the bar be given the authority to dissolve this and in its place establish within its structure or in cooperation with other structures something that will be more responsive to the needs, more flexible in the way it can handle them, and more effective where you have these problems. And when I say these problems, one of the difficulties with the rule as it now stands is that there must be a solo practitioner. The solo practitioner must be deceased, disabled, or I even forget the third. Disappeared.
Disappeared. Yeah.
We have one case where the bar has been involved, where that isn't a situation at all. The attorney is simply disinterested.
There's another dis. Don't dis.
Walking the streets of his hometown and not
caring.
Not caring. Also, we have the situation where rather than a sole practitioner, you might have someone in some kind of a partnership. I predicate this idea of Jones and Jones, where the senior Jones is 80, the younger Jones is 50, the younger Jones gets hit by the trash truck. And while the Chief Justice has pointed out to me that the age of 80 is not necessarily a limiting factor on anyone's abilities.
We had a lengthy discussion about that before the hearing.
Yes. Let us presume that this particular 80-year-old Mr. Jones is retired, semi-competent. The rule doesn't cover that situation. The rule doesn't cover the disinterested lawyer situation. So I think we can do better if we internalize this in the state bar. Let the state bar give its final blessing to the Lawyers Assistance Corporation with your approval, and move on to something better.
Thank you, Mr. Horton. Are there any questions? Justice Prosser.
Mr. Horton, there are an awful lot of young attorneys who are unemployed. Is there any effort when a sole practitioner dies or is disabled or disappears, is there any effort by anybody to put, say, a young attorney in this position to maybe take over the practice?
Justice Prosser, I'm not aware of a formalized process. I believe we have within the state bar, and I could easily be corrected on this, and within both of the law schools in the state, programs of, if you will, employment, And I think that there is some activity there. I don't believe that they specifically target a deceased lawyer, disabled lawyer, disappeared lawyer, and say, we've got this bright, fresh face that we can put in place of that one. I think the dynamics of it are a little more complicated than that, because you may have the deceased lawyer may be one who has established a great deal of expertise in a particular field, and bringing in the someone new might not provide the same level of competence and services.
Is the trustee always pro bono?
It was carefully not covered in the rule. I am not aware of any that have been paid. Their expenses, a lot of money has gone into payment of their expenses, as Justice Bradley indicated. I don't know of any that have received compensation beyond the just reimbursement.
If I just may, I think that under 1202, perhaps there's some provisions regarding compensation for the trustee attorney surrounding there.
But again, since none of them go through that program.
You don't, yeah, that's not your bailiwick.
Right, but if a lawyer or a group does close out cases, it's possible that there will be receipts, which may or may not be so used. The thing that occurs to me, Mr. Horton, is that to the extent this isn't being used and is closed out, we're in the same position we were. But it raises an issue of what the State Bar ought to be doing other than this corporation in taking care of these eventualities. And that's something that the Bar will have to deal with.
And it has been doing this, and we have been in contact with OLR, with the Client Security Fund, with a lot of people on an informal basis to say, what can we put together?
Right. Good. But this is not the answer in Europe.
This is not the answer.
Thank you, Mr. Horton. Any other questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there any other appearances in behalf of or in opposition to the petition to amend the Supreme Court rules concerning the Lawyers Assistance Corporation? Hearing none, we conclude our hearing on 10-07 in the matter of the petition to amend Supreme Court Rules 12.02 sub 6 and 12.03 sub 7 concerning the Lawyers Assistance Corporation. The court will take a break for lunch and return at 1:30, and we will then discuss 0501, 1007, and we will hear from John Velker and Jean Buscat, re-expunction of circuit court records, and we'll discuss 0604A and any other items still remaining on our open court agenda. We are adjourned in recess till 1:30.